All right, I think we can get started. Just a very brief introduction. A pleasure to welcome Rabbi Chaim Schaffner. As you hear, he is the rabbi of the shul closest to the White House and Kesher Israel in Washington, D.C. And prior to that, served for 13 years as a rabbi of Beis Abraham in St. Louis, and then served as a Hillel director of Washington University for, I believe, 8 years. And he served as a rabbi in India. That's very interesting. I'd like to hear about that sometime. It's a pleasure to welcome back. I think this the second time speaking for Torah Motions. So, Vakasha, I'm one of not an easy parsha necessary to give a shir on, so it's all yours, Vakasha.
Thank you. Thank you. By the way, I should do my India talk sometime for.
Okay. I don't know about it.
I have like this whole slideshow about how much I learned from the Jews of India.
Very nice. Okay, great.
Okay. Should I just share my screen?
Yeah. You can share your screen. Okay. Yeah, I'll post the sources in a second, but yeah, you can share the screen. Vakasha.
Okay. Everybody can see that? Okay, great. So, the whole beginning of Shemos, obviously, I mean, the Jews come out of Egypt, they go to Mount Sinai, but in a way, in this four or five parshas that we're in the middle of, that are about the Mishkan. And Aviva Zornberg points this out, among others, there's a chiastic structure to it. You have Truma, which Moshe's on the mountain. By the way, if you look at the text of the Torah, it seems like all Moshe receives on the mountain is the laws of the Mishkan. So that's Truma and Tetzaveh. First, God tells him about the vessels of the Mishkan and then about the surrounding of the Mishkan. And then, we have Kisisa, in which they are told about Shabbos. Moshe is told about Shabbos. Then the Jewish people worship the golden calf. Then Moshe comes down and breaks the tablets. He gets forgiveness for the Jewish people. He then tells the Jewish people about Shabbos and kind of reverses the structure. He tells them about the Mishkan and the vessels, and then the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. And so you have the Mishkan in the middle, surrounded by Shabbos. You have the golden calf in the middle, surrounded by Shabbos on both sides, and then surrounded by the laws of the tabernacle. And so there's always a deep relationship between Shabbos and the tabernacle. And we know this in Halakha also. The Gemara says, since the Torah says, you're not allowed, Ached Shabto Taiti Shmoru, you should build the Mishkan, but you should guard my Shabbos. Meaning, Gemara learns from that even though it's a mitzvah to build the tabernacle, you're not allowed to do it on Shabbat. And we actually derive from that Shabbat essentially is a non-building of the Mishkan. Meaning that all the laws of Shabbat that you're not allowed to do, all the 39 categories of law, we learn that from the process of building the Mishkan. Process of making the cloth for the Mishkan, the process of dyeing the cloth, process of planting in order to make the bread for the Mishkan, the process of even carrying. They have to carry the parts of the Mishkan, and so you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos. Writing was in order to put together the different staves of the Mishkan. You had to know which one went into which. And so you would write a letter on one, a letter on the other, and that's why you're not allowed to write more than two letters on Shabbos. And so Shabbos and the Mishkan are deeply intertwined. And on some level, the question is why? I mean, the Mishkan seems very separate from Shabbos. This also seems to have, the Mishkan and Shabbos also seem to have something to do in these parshiot with the worship of the golden calf. Rashi assumes that the Torah here is in the wrong order. I'm going to start from where it says the Mishkan as a tikkun for the golden calf, and then I'll go up to the top paragraph. Right? Rashi says, Avayitein al Moshe, Ein muktam amucha batorah. He says there's no order to the way that the Torah is written. There's some order to the way the Torah is written, but there are things in the Torah that are out of order. He says, even though in the Torah itself, Moshe is commanded about the Mishkan, then they worship the golden calf. He says, that's not really the way it happened. The way it happened was, Masa Egel Kodem Letzivim Lechza Mishkan. The Egel, the worship of the golden calf, was first. And then was the commandment about the Mishkan and the building of the Mishkan. And he proves that from kind of the timeline, because we know that on the 17th of Tammuz, Moshe broke the tablets. And on Yom Kippur, the Jewish people were forgiven, and Moshe comes down with the second set of tablets. And then they built the Mishkan, because the Mishkan is established on the first day of Nisan. So Rashi says, if you think about the timeline, the Torah can't be in the right order. It can't be that, I mean, the truth is that really, if you think about it, the Egel, the golden calf, comes, and then the Jewish people build the tabernacle, even in the Torah itself. So it doesn't have to be in the wrong order. So it's funny that Rashi says this. What's in the wrong order is God commanding Moshe. What Rashi seems to be implying is that without the golden calf, God wouldn't even have commanded Moshe about the tabernacle, or else it is in the right order. The golden calf was in last week's parsha. In this week's parsha, we're talking about the building of the tabernacle. So what does Rashi mean? So the answer is Rashi seems to think that there would have been no Mishkan without the golden calf. In other words, that on some level, the Mishkan is a response to the golden calf. And of course, the Rambam very famously says this also. And he says in the Moreh Nevuchim, the guy's perplexed. I won't read the whole thing. But it's an idea that the Rambam says very often. Very often in the Guides of the Perplexed, the Rambam says the reason that for certain mitzvot is because they used to be done by idolaters, and God wanted to take the Jews away from idolatry. And so here the Rambam says, why did God give them the Mishkan and the sacrifices? The answer is that it's very hard for people to change. And the Jewish people had lived in Egypt. They lived among idolaters. And God didn't want them to worship idolatry, but he couldn't just tell them, don't worship idolatry. In fact, that didn't work. That they worshiped the golden calf. Rather, he had to sort of slowly nurture them away from that. And the Mishkan and the sacrifices was a way of saying to the Jews, okay, I'm going to give you sort of the methods of idolatry, but do it for me. And slowly the Rambam says the goal wasn't to just to have a Mishkan. The goal really was to get the Jews away eventually from sacrifices toward prayer, or the Rambam seems to indicate maybe it may be even something higher. The Ramban very famously, you know, calls Rashi names over this. not exactly calling Rashi names, but he calls Rashi's interpretation ridiculous. And he proves in many ways that sacrifices are very much inherent in Judaism. They're not just there. But that's what the Rambam thought. And you can see from Rashi that that it seems like there might not have been a Mishkan without the worship of the golden calf, that the Mishkan is a response to the worship of the golden calf. And this whole idea you see in a Rashi in Bereshit, right? It says that that's at the top of the page, that their eyes were opened and they realized that they were naked. This is obviously talking about Adam and Eve eating from the tree. And they made fig leaves, and they made belts out of fig leaves, loincloths out of fig leaves to cover themselves. Now, why did they do that? Obviously, on a practical level, a fig leaf is very big and it's shaped the right way. That's why they use it, in statues, Greek statues that they want to cover in certain museums. But Rashi says something else. He says it must be, and the Gemara itself has a discussion of what tree they ate from. The Gemara has many, many suggestions, like seven or eight different suggestions of what tree they ate from, an etrog tree, wheat. But Rashi says it must have been alei te'ena, must have been a fig tree, because but davar shenit kalkalu bo nitkenu. Now, you might think it was a fig tree on just a practical level, right? The closest tree, once you sinned, the moment you realize you're naked, well, if it was from eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so the closest tree is going to be the knowledge of good and evil. If the first thing they put on is fig leaves, must be that was a fig tree. But that's not what Rashi says. Rashi is saying something much more philosophical. He's saying it was the fig tree because the tikkun, the fixing, had to come from the agent of sin, the agent of the downfall. And if their downfall was through the fig tree, therefore the fixing of it, the covering of themselves, came through the fig tree also. Okay, and then he gives a reason why about the other trees, but that's the fundamental idea. Is that I think you're seeing this reflected in this Rashi about in the parsha about the Mishkan and the golden calf, and that on some level that's the function of the Mishkan. What does this have to do with Shabbos? So we'll get to that. Well, let me actually ask that, right? Why is Shabbos important? If the function of the Mishkan is as a tikkun for the golden calf, why is Shabbat an important element? So I think the answer is that, and this is said by others, I think Viv Zorberg says this also, in the same place in her book on Shemot, that in a certain sense, giving a people that worship the golden calf a Mishkan, which is filled with gold, is a terrible idea. In fact, there's a medrash that says that the faces of the cherubs that were on top of the ark were not, you know, babies like some Mefarshim say, some commentaries say, but were the heads of calves. They were golden calves. In fact, we see later in Navi that when Yeravam, the evil king of the north, wants to stop the Jewish people from going to the south to worship in the temple because he wants the northern kingdom to stay separate, what does he do? He sets up essentially his own tabernacles. What is it? He sets up two golden calves. On some level, the golden calf is that because the original service of idolatry the Jewish people do is a golden calf, and so this reminds him of that? Or is it that there's something fundamental about a golden calf, that on some level a golden calf is the most obvious representation of the deity, or it's the most basic idolatry, or the most obvious idolatry? Now, to us, it doesn't make any sense. You know, a golden calf doesn't seem any different than a golden fish, but on some level, you find the golden calf more than once. And there's something about a golden calf, but so in a way, I mean, aren't you just giving them more of the golden calf? It's true, like the Rambam says that it's for God, but isn't it just going to get out of control? In fact, it does get out of control later on in history when idols, Baal and others are brought into the temple. And so on some level, Shabbat is the opposite of the Mishkan, right? It is the breaks on the Mishkan. And that's what Shabbat is, right? Because the laws of Shabbat are all of the things that you might do to build a Mishkan, that you do to build a Mishkan. That's precisely what you're not allowed to do on Shabbat. Shabbat essentially is the not building of the Mishkan. That's the fundamental aspect of Shabbos. You are not building the Mishkan. Everything you can't do on Shabbos is because those things are done to build the Mishkan. And so the golden calf, which was this, jumping into, right? Moshe is a few minutes late, and the Jewish people say, Haish Moshe, this man Moshe, we don't know what happened to him. Let's get up and Nase Lanu Elokim. Let's make a God who can go before us. And the Jewish people, they don't wait a minute. Moshe's gone, boom. They are terrified. And had they taken a breath and thought about it, they might not have built the golden calf. They might have calmed themselves down, but they're so scared. They're so much like little children. They're so terrified when Moshe is gone. The Medrash says he was supposed to come back at noon, and they waited a few hours, and that was it. No, he had said Bo Shesh. Bo Shesh Moshe. He was supposed to come at 6, and he didn't. They waited a few hours. And they couldn't handle it, so they built this golden calf to if you look at the text of the Chumash, it's to take Moshe's place. But there's no thinking, there's just acting. And Shabbat is the opposite of that, right? Shabbat is just thinking and no acting. I mean, in a sense, it's not creating anything, it is just reflection. And that's exactly what the Jewish people needed at that moment and didn't have. And so God could have given them just Shabbos, really, if you think about it. Just Shabbos probably would have been enough. But the Mishkan seems to, at least according to the Rambam and Rashi, seems to be important for redirecting their golden calf energy. But if it doesn't come along with Shabbos, it will get out of control. You see this reflected, I think, in the following Sfarno. The Sfarno says, "V'yom Shvi'i Elochem Shabbos Kodesh, Kodesh, seventh day should be holy to you. V'lo tasu bo afilu malechas haMishkan. Don't even do the work in the Mishkan that we know generally. Kol osa bo malecha yumat. Anybody who does work on it will die. Afal pi shehi malechet mitzvah. Even though it is mitzvah work, holy work. In other words, it's surprising, right? The Sforno is surprised that building the Mishkan on Shabbos should be a problem. Because it's a mitzvah to build the Mishkan. Like, why? In fact, there's other mitzvahs we do on Shabbos. We violate Shabbos in the temple all the time. We bring karbanos on Shabbos. We bring a shachris. We bring the karban tamid shel shachar. We bring a sacrifice twice a day. We bring a musaf offering on Shabbos. We violate Shabbos all the time in the Mishkan. The building of the Mishkan, you're not allowed to violate Shabbos. But the worship of the Mishkan, we assume that God, just like God commanded us not to build the Mishkan on Shabbos and not to violate Shabbos, God, the same God commanded us to bring sacrifices on Shabbos. And so we do that. But he says, afal pi shi malechet mitzvah. No, even a mitzvah you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Meaning, fundamentally, the building of the Mishkan. Take a look. This is the Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He writes, it says in Parshas Kisisa, which was last week's Parsha, K'tivit writes, Yeoseh malecha. No work should be done on the Shabbos. Im kein mashma kol oseh hamalacha, shemehem yaseh hamalacha, aval kan k'tiv ta'aseh. Here it says, no work should be done. In other words, over there, you should not do any work. Over here, it says, no work should be done. Well, what does it mean? It's more passive. Koyah malacha b'lasha nikva. It sounds like even passive work cannot get done. V'imkein nitan lahavin, therefore we can see, shafilu lahatchil b'malacha v'yigmar me'atzma b'shabbat kodesh demutter. Generally, we have a law. The Talmud says, let's say that you have a hydro grain grinder mill, a hydro mill for grain, and you put the grain in right before Shabbos, and the water is turning the grinding wheel, and it's going to keep turning it on Shabbos. Is that permitted or not? Right? No different than, let's say, I put food in my oven. It's not fully cooked. I want it to cook on Shabbos. Or I start running my dishwasher right before Shabbos. It's going to keep running during Shabbos. Is that permitted or not? The answer is it is permitted, because though you are not allowed to do work, your vessels are allowed to do work on Shabbos. That's why you can keep your fire on over Shabbos, in your oven or your stove, as long as you turned it on before Shabbos. That's why your air conditioning is allowed to run on Shabbos. But says the Hamak Dover, he says, you see from the language that there's a kind of passive forbiddenness here, that even work being done seems to be forbidden. And he says, we can understand from this that even though on Shabbos you're allowed to start work before Shabbos that will be completed on Shabbos, nevertheless, when it comes to building the Mishkan, it's forbidden. Shein kovod ha-mishkan she'yadcha she'yichal k'dusha Shabbos. He says, You let's say there was you need to grind grain for the Mishkan, for the building of the Mishkan, or you need to grind up dyes, certain things to make dye to dye the walls of the Mishkan, and you want to set the grinder before Shabbos. It's going to keep going on Shabbos. Are you allowed to do it? So Rabbi Berlin here says, no, you can't do that. That's what we learn from the language of ta'aseh, no work should be done. That's even though on a regular Shabbos, you're allowed to do that. But if it's to build the Mishkan, you can't do that. You can't, in other words, even something which is permitted on Shabbos, it's fully permitted to do that on Shabbos. But the violation of Shabbos can't even touch the Mishkan. And so even though it would be permitted to set the machine before Shabbos, to build the Mishkan, you can't do that. Somehow the Mishkan cannot be touched by the violation of Shabbos. That's what he's saying. So it goes even further, right? It's not even the violation of Shabbos. It's permitted. But to build the Mishkan, he says, you can't do that because the violation of Shabbos is anathema to the Mishkan. So why is that, right? There's this, it's almost like the Mishkan comes with this boundary of Shabbat in a very extreme way. And that, of course, is the idea that if the Mishkan is going to be a tikkun for the golden calf, as I think Rashi is indicating, and maybe, I don't think the Rambam is exactly saying this. I think he's saying something more psychological and practical, but I think there's something much deeper here, much more fundamental, that the Mishkan is not just a way of getting the Jews to not worship idols. It's like Rashi said, it's like taking the fig leaf and changing it into something positive. It's taking your sin, taking your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination, and curbing it towards something good. There's a story in the Gemara of a certain rabbi who saw this man and woman walk into the forest. And he says, oh, I'll follow them and stop them from sinning. And nothing happens. The man and woman just talk. They leave the forest. And it was Rabbi Zeira, I think. And he was very upset at himself because he says, wow, I assumed they were going to sin because that's what I would have done. And he's very depressed. And Elijah the prophet comes to him and says to him, Misha gadol mechaveiro, Yitzro gadol hemenu. Whoever is greater than their neighbor, so too is their inclination greater than their neighbor. In other words, he's saying to Rabbi Zeira, you have such a strong inclination for sin, but that's what makes you so great. You don't give into it, obviously. If you gave into it, you'd be the worst person. But the worst person is the one who has the power to be the best person. Because inclination, nothing's really negative or positive. Everything is neutral. It's just how you use it. And so the word yetzer, inclination, actually comes from the word vayetzer, to create, to form something. It's creativity. It's like Freud said, that the libido is the creative energy in the human being. But left unchecked, it can go wild and can lead us to sin. And so that's the idea, is that not just that the Mishkan is there to wean the Jews away from the golden calf, but the Mishkan is actually like the fig leaf. It is a utilizing of the sin of gold and bowing and worship and sacrifices. It is the golden calf turned on its head. It's the other side of the coin of the golden calf. It's the golden calf, but used in a positive way. It's the energy of that idolatry, but used for good. We don't have the desire for idolatry anymore, which makes you wonder, what are we missing, actually? Right? In other words, on some level, they say that idolatry and prophecy, the desire for idolatry and prophecy sort of came together. They were also different sides of the same coin. Yes, potentially. I agree with you. Right. Everything has a potential for positive and negative. There's a Gemara in which a certain rabbi says, in Judaism, everything is permitted. And they say to him, what do you mean everything's permitted? What about cooking? What about milk and meat cooked together? And he says, roast for him in udder, because the udder tastes like milk and meat. Right? Everything's permitted. It's just, right, in Judaism, really nothing is forbidden. It's just that everything has a context. Everything, and the more powerful some yetzer is, the more powerful some inclination is, the more laws it has, because it needs that in order to curb it. So that is the Mishkan as tikkun. I think also that you can see this in the vessels of the Mishkan, and I'll do the ark as an example. I haven't played out all the vessels, but we see this with the ark. It says about the ark. The ark, of course, in our parsha is the first thing that's commanded. Vasu aron atzei shitim. Make the ark out of shitim wood, acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. And coat it with gold, inside it out, and make a gold molding around it. So the Medrash Rabbah says, that Medrash is sort of wondering, why does it have to be made out of shittim wood? Why? Rashi, by the way, says, if you look at this, did I quote the Rashi? I didn't quote the Rashi. Rashi says that the way this, that Bezalel made the ark was made a, he made three boxes. One box was gold and it was very big, a medium box of acacia wood, and a smaller box of gold. And he put the small box of gold inside the wooden box and the whole, those two inside the bigger box of gold. And so you couldn't see the wooden box. All you saw was the gold on the outside. Here in the Torah, it says it was just coated. Barash says it's more than that. It was really three different boxes. And so it's all gold on the outside. But on the inside, if you know what it's made out of, it's actually shittim wood on the inside. Why shittim wood? So the Midrash says that, in midosav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the characteristics of God are not like people. The characteristics of people are that you cut with a knife and you heal with a bandage. But God, with that which God cuts, with that which God damages, God heals. As it says, and they came to Marata, and there was no water to drink because the waters were bitter. And they cried out to God. And what did God say to do? He said to take this this tree branch and throw it in. And the tree branch itself was just a tree branch. It was bitter, but it made the water sweet. And so too, he says that we see this also with the ark. How so? The Jewish people sinned with Baal Peor. If you remember in the book of Bamidbar, the Jewish in Bilam fails to curse the Jewish people. And so he tells Balak, the king of Moab, get the Jewish people to worship idols and then they'll be weak. You'll be able to defeat them. And so Balak sends out the daughters of Midian with, entice the Jews both sexually and for idolatry, to get them to worship Baal Peor. And you remember the story that Cosby and Zimri are there in the middle of everybody worshiping Baal Peor and engages in sexual intercourse, and Pinchas comes and he stabs them both, and then the plague ends. That all happens in a place called Shittim. And so the Midrash says, just as the Jews sinned in Shittim, so the nirpu b'shittim, so their healing comes through shittim, through acacia wood. As it says, and Bezalel made the ark out of shittim wood, out of acacia wood. And so the Midrash says, is saying basically that the ark itself, it's relating it to the sin of Baal Peor, but of course, the sin of the golden calf is a very similar sin. In fact, the rabbis say that the Dionysian image of the golden calf was not just idolatry. It was actually also a sort of a sexual that was also a way of serving Baal Peor. But here's the Rashi. Rashi says that there were three arcs, one inside of the other. Rabbi Tzadok, a coin of Lublin, has the following comment. Any questions so far? Everybody okay? So Rav Tzadok says, Rav Tzadok was a great Hasidic rabbi who he wrote a lot of different books, Tzidkas Tzadok and others, but also a book on the Torah portions called Pri Tzadok. And here he's talking about, he says a very similar idea to the Midrash, but he says it slightly differently. He says, he quotes the Rashi that there were three arcs, one inside of the other. And that this is not how the other vessels were made. The other vessels, some of them were made out of wood and coated with gold. But here he points out he's interested in this three arc design, one inside the other, like those, Russian dolls. You want to know why it's done that way. Why not just make it out of wood and coat it with gold? So he says the word shitim, the word acacia wood, shitim is connected to the word shtut. Shtut means frivolity or silliness. And he quotes the Gemara on Sota, Ein Adam over Avera, nobody sins, Elaim kein nichnas bo ruach shtut. People only sin when a spirit of folly enters them. Right? This is often true, that sometimes a person sins and they can't even sort of, it's surprising to them, right? Later on, they can't really even understand how they could sin. It doesn't seem like them. It seems like someone else. It seems like, you know, why would I do such a thing? And people could just compartmentalize that, but often it's very hard to integrate our side. If we're somebody who is both righteous and sinful, it's very hard to integrate that because it seems like someone else. You know, that's not me. So he says, the Gemara says, this is the concept of sin, that nichnas baruch shtu, there's some spirit, some otherness, spirit of otherness that kind of enters the person. And it's a spirit of folly in the sense that we're not thinking about the import of our life. We're not thinking about the big picture, the big questions when we sin. In fact, sometimes sin is an escape from those things. Inyan hataiva hu be'emes shtus v'tifshus. The concept of desire, he says, is connected to folly. Shudavermos. Ve'ein shtus v'tifshus godol mizeh. And when it comes to worshiping Baal Pa'ar, or worshiping the golden calf, chote mitayv atzmo b'shvil milei tavata, we have a desire in the moment to fulfill our what we want. Umafsi tov olam haba, but we're losing out on something. We're losing out on what we think we should do on the world to come. In other words, a lot of times people know intellectually that they should not do something, but they do it anyway. Why is that? That's very strange. Right? In other words, if we know intellectually that we want to act a certain way and that we should act a certain way, why don't we act that way? Somehow desire lies in the emotive space, right? As the medievals put it, in the heart. And the mind knows something different. But somehow the person doesn't follow the mind. It's very perplexing. So this is the concept of ruach shtut. This is why the Talmud says this. Because it must be some kind of other spirit. Because me, why would I do that? I don't think I should do that. So how could I do that? Ve'en shtus v'tipshus gadol mizeh. There's nothing more frivolous than following one's desire for a moment when intellectually they know they shouldn't. Uvishitim kilkalu b'maspar, and in the place called Shitim, that's where they worshipped this idol in Numbers in Bamidbar. V'ze'inyan, and he says this is also the concept of the ark that is made out of Shitim wood, because obviously the Shitim wood, the acacia wood, represents the inclination, the evil inclination for desire. And then he quotes the Gemara that I just mentioned, that anybody who is greater than their neighbor, so too is their yetzer, their inclination, greater than their neighbor. He says, we can understand this also, that a Talmid Chacham, somebody who has the potential to be a great scholar, also has a great yetzer, has a great desire, has a great inclination. The yetzer, hainu cheshek. What is yetzer? It is just pure desire. It's passion. But again, it's undifferentiated passion. And that's what it's all about. How do we differentiate it one way or the other, positive or negative? And then he says an interesting thing. He says that, that there is, this is sometimes called in Kabbalah, the klipa, the shell, or the place of evil is called the shell. And there are two main klipot. One is Ishmael and one is Esau. And he says that klipot Yishmael, the one of Ishmael, is desire. And the one of Esav is it. So the one of Yishmael is the desire for desire, for idolatry, for sexuality. The one of Esau is aggression, rechitza v'kas, anger and the desire to kill. Right? By the way, Freud said that we have two fundamental desires, sex and aggression. That's exactly what Ruth Tzadok HaKohen is saying here, that Ishmael represents the desire for sexuality, which idolatry is part of that, and Esau represents the fundamental drive of aggression. He says, but we actually need these things. We need aggression sometimes. You know when? When it's time to destroy Amalek, we need aggression. When it's time when the rabbis have to stand up and say something, they need aggression. And so that's an important thing. And the same thing, obviously, with the klipa of Yishmael, which is the evil inclination for desire. And you need that. What do you need that for? He says, you need that. That is the source of everything creative. It's the source of Torah, he says. You wouldn't study Torah without the desire of Ishmael, without the Yetzer, without the Freud's, I'll call one libido and one aggression, without Freud's libido. and so we need them both. And he says, but there will be a time. And he says the Ishmaelite sort of libidinal desire, that's what fuels Torah, chemda d'oraita. Yes, drive. I'm sorry. That's much better. Drive. Freud talked about the drives. That's right. And so we have these two fundamental drives. They can be negative because they lead to murder and anger, and they lead to idolatry and forbidden sexuality. But they also lead to aggression that needs to be used for things like war, and the drive for and the libidinal drive, which needs to be used, he says, for Torah study. You wouldn't actually, right? That creativity of Torah study comes from a place of libidinal drive. Rome is the very, and he says, but the time will come. He says, La'atid, in the time of the Messiah, kishid labin hayetzer hara d'taiva. He says, what's going to happen is one of these is going to be retained, and one of them is going to be erased in the time of the Mashiach. In the time of the Mashiach, the Esau drive of aggression, of killing, is going to be erased, because we know that it will be a time of peace, when the lion will lie down with the lamb and those kinds of things. But what about the desire of Ishmael? What about the drive, the libidinal drive? So he says that we're going to retain in the time of the Messiah, because without it, there's no desire for Torah. Oz yishapek hanachal liyot me'ein beit Hashem lachnis cheshek haTorah b'lev Yisrael. So he's quoting a pasuk here from Yoel. B'haya b'yamahu will be on that day. Yitfu harim asim v'agvot telach nachalav. It will be that the mountains are dripping with sweet, and the high places are flowing with milk. And all of the springs of Judah will be springing with water. And a spring will come out of the house of God. It will water what? At Nachal HaShittim. It will water the Valley of Shittim. The Valley of Shittim is where they sinned with Baal Pa'ar. Where they sinned, that's Shittim. But the water will come, the spring will come out of the house of God, out of the Mishkan, and it will water the place of Shittim. In other words, you will still always have that desire of Shittim, but it will be curbed into its better place, which is a place of desire for Torah. Shal yedei she'elsak b'torah b'lev shalom b'tocho kvar sheratz l'istabek b'kedushas yisparach. Because what is studying Torah? It is the desire to cling to God, right? What is sexual desire is the desire for unity, for merging. And so you can't get rid of that because we need that to connect with God. Aggression we can get rid of. And he says that's why the golden parts of the ark on the outside represent Torah. But the inside, the thing that fuels it, is Shittim, wood. Because Shittim is the place where the sin took place, and Shittim represents that Yetzer Hara of Ishmael. And ultimately, we will retain it, but it gets retained within the Torah. And Umayan Mibet Hashem Yatzan, and it gets nourished, by the Shittim gets, the Nachal Shittim gets nourished by the Torah, because that Yetzer, that desire, becomes mixed in with Torah and fuels the Torah, is the drive that makes Torah possible, in the future. So that's the ark, right? So the ark is the thing that, is also a great tikkun for the golden calf, because it shittim wood, which is within it, the whole notion of curbing the idolatrous desire into something positive is the notion of the ark and the gold which surrounds the shittim wood. I'll just finish with something from the Tusher Rebbe.
The Yiddish for shittim is nourish. It nourishes.
Oh, like for shtus is nourish.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, nourish kind. Sure. Yeah. That's right. So this is a piece from the Tusher Rebbe. Tusher Rebbe lived in Canada. He was Rabbi Meshulam Feish of Tush. He came from Europe after the war. Yeah, he was a great, great tzaddik, known to do miracles and all kinds of interesting things. He had a very large, a significant Hasidic group, in a suburb of Montreal called Brebois. And, he died about, probably 15, 20 years ago. And so they've been writing down his work. He would sometimes tell Hasidic stories, but there's also two volumes of Torah on the Torah portions, which are very beautiful. And and here he talks about a relationship between Shabbat and the Mishkan. And my sense from it is that you can see how the Mishkan is not really about the Mishkan. In a certain sense, the Mishkan is about Shabbat. Everything is about Shabbat. And that not only is the Mishkan a tikkun for the golden calf, but really Shabbat is also, because Shabbat and the Mishkan are intertwined. So he writes, 6 days you shall work, and on the seventh day is Shabbos, it's holy. So the rabbis ask, Rashi says, why does the Torah warn us here about Shabbos right before we are commanded about the Mishkan? We already know about Shabbos, in Parshat Yitzro, we know about it in last week's Parshat Ki Tiso. Why is it repeated here again after the golden calf when Moshe is about to command the Jewish people about the Mishkan? It says also, the mitzvahs of the Torah are forever and they apply to people at all times. And so how is the concept of, it seems like a quarter of the Torah is all about building the Mishkan. Why do we need that? It's not forever. It doesn't apply in all times. It doesn't apply to us today. So what's its purpose? He says, Inyan, the concept is, Yiduash, he says, yeah, it is known that the whole concept of building the Mishkan was in order to have the light of God shine within the Jewish people. As it says, make for me a Mishkan, Asuli Mikdash, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell among them. And the Shlei Luchot HaBrit says, it doesn't say bitocho, I will dwell in it. It says, I will dwell among them. Meaning, bitocham, in them, I will dwell in each one of the Jewish people. Because the Shechinah, the divine presence in the Mishkan, It's true. It was in the Mishkan. How does it get to the people? Hashpia or v'chiyut elikut l'toch libo. The divine presence in the Mishkan flowed then into the heart of each person in the Jewish people. And it was, the Mishkan was sort of facilitating the flow of divine light into individuals, into us as a people. V'lozu b'vad, not only that, ela mehashrad ha-shchina shebe-mishkan, from the divine presence in the Mishkan, there was a, there's a flow of divine light that goes out to the whole world. Hashefa v'hachiyot she'akadosh baruch hu mashpia b'chol rega. There's a Kabbalistic concept. The world is not just created, but the world is constantly being emanated from the divine. In other words, the real state of the world is nothingness. The ultimate paradox of the universe is, why is there anything? Right? That's the problem. We just take it for granted, but really there should be nothing. So why is there anything? So in Kabbalah, there's a sense that there's only anything because God is constantly willing it, projecting it, or else there really would be nothing. The basic state of things is that there's nothing. This constant hashpa, this constant divine projection at every moment, that's what gives us a life force in the world, and that's what creates existence. So all of this comes through the Mishkan. Kamosh Matzino, as it says, that in the Mishkan there was Evan Shesia. There was a rock in the Holy of Holies that was called Evan Shesia. Why? Because from it, Hushtat HaOlam, the world came to be. Shederach Sham, that's where the Shefa, that's where the divine flow came from that gives presence, existence to the world. Ine Yedua, and he says, it says in the Zohar that all blessings above and below come through the day of Shabbos. They depend on Shabbos. And they are umine mitbarchin kol shita yomin iloyin. And all the 7 days are blessed through Shabbos. That the Shabbos is the makor, is the source for all the blessing, for all the divine light that gives light to the worlds. Now that sounds very similar to what we just said about the Mishkan. So he says it must be that even the divine light which goes through the Mishkan comes from somewhere. Where does it come from? It goes through the Mishkan into the hearts of the Jewish people and into the whole world. But it comes from Shabbos. Kol nimshach ayde yom Shabbos kodesh. Yora Shabbos, he makora dekula. Says the Mishkan isn't the source, Shabbos is the source. And of course, this would explain why you're not allowed to, why Shabbos trumps the Mishkan. The Mishkan gets its divine light from Shabbos. And that's why it says in the holy books that even when the temple is destroyed, we can still get divine light in this world. Why? Because it comes through Shabbos. Shabbos is still there, and Shabbos was the original source. And in fact, he says, Shabbos during exile, gedolim odiyoter me'ashabbatot bizman ha-mikdash. This is shocking. He says, Shabbos during exile is greater than Shabbos at the time of the temple, at the time, which is surprising. Kamosha, maybe, I guess because it's more, I don't know, the divine light therefore comes more directly from Shabbos. As the rabbi of Kamarna said in the name of Rabbi Aryeh Leibish of Landstut, I don't know where that is. Alakas of Kol Yimei Hashama Tishpot. It says in Vayikra that in the curses, if the Jewish people don't keep the sabbatical year, that they'll be kicked out of the land, and all the days of its desolation, the land will rest. So he says, it's not talking about the sabbatical year, it's talking about Shabbat every week, Shabbat generally. And he says that, that it's referring to exile. And what it means is, kol yimei ha-shama tishpot, that Shabbat will be even more powerful during the yimei ha-shama, the days of exile. And this is why in Licha Dodi and Kabbalat Shabbat, we say, Rav Lach Shevet B'Emek Habacha. You dwell in the Valley of Tears. Shevet sounds not just dwell, but sounds like Shabbat. Shekoach haShabbat shebeimek habacha. The power of Shabbat is in the Valley of Tears, in the days of exile. That's where the powerfulness of Shabbat is, more so than Shabbat at the time of the redemption, at the time of the Mishkan. Why is that? Even at the time of the temple, Shabbat is the source of everything. Somehow this is, because there's no Mishkan, it comes more directly from Shabbos. So this is why he says Shabbos is commanded in our parsha right before the Mishkan, in order to teach us that the source of all the power of the Mishkan, the source of all the divine light of the Mishkan, which comes to us, its source is in Shabbos. Shabbos is the source of everything and of all divine flow. This is what the rabbis say, that the verse comes to teach us that the work of the Mishkan does not push aside Shabbos because of what we said. Because Shabbos is more important than the Mishkan. Shabbos is the ultimate source. So I think the idea here he's saying is that not only is the Mishkan a tikkun, the Mishkan maybe should not have necessarily existed, but it comes to be a way of utilizing whatever it was the Jews were utilizing for the golden calf, but we have Shabbos also that can do that. Shabbat is a Mishkan. As Heschel said, Shabbat is the Mishkan in time, and the Mishkan is the Mishkan in space. But for us, we should think about how is it, we understand the concept of the Ark being the Tikkun, the Mishkan being the Tikkun. They are sort of ways of worshiping idols, and Shabbat, I had said at the beginning, was a way of just ensuring that they don't become like the golden calf. But I think the Rebbe here is saying much more than that, that Shabbat itself is the Mishkan. Shabbat is the source of the Mishkan. Shabbat can take the place of the Mishkan. And so in some way, Shabbat also is it's almost a higher tikkun for the golden calf. Because if you think about it, Mishkan is a tikkun for the golden calf by curbing, by letting us utilize our desire for sort of like idolatry, but curbing it. But Shabbat is different. Shabbat doesn't do that. You can't worship on Shabbat like you would in the temple. You can't build a temple on Shabbat. Shabbat calms it. Shabbat is the reflection that the Jews had needed. Shabbat is it's a redirecting of our passions in a whole different way. In fact, sometimes when Shabbat comes, you feel different, right? You often, you might desire money. You might desire all kinds of things. Shabbat comes and that all fades away. It's shocking, really. I think many people feel this. And so it does more than just retain the desire, but curb it. Shabbat somehow resolves it. Shabbat somehow, it becomes a time of oneg becomes permitted and redirected. And it becomes much easier. It's much easier to be holy on Shabbos. During the week, in a Kabbalistic sense, you have to have certain kavanah, you have to have certain intent when you eat. But on Shabbos, that's all miraculous. You know, it doesn't matter what your intent is. Everything is sanctified. Everything is sanctified. It's like a true Mishkan. And so in that sense, there's no danger of the golden calf on Shabbos because you're not doing. There's no desire to do. There's no desire for that kind of worship. There's calm and the spirit settles upon us without any intermediary. Any questions or thoughts?
Thank you. That was great.
Rob, if no one has anybody want to say something? Otherwise, I'll add a very quick comment. It's interesting. I just did my podcast this week on the parsha of the 10 minutes. I spoke on Shabbos and the Mishkan, but when the pasuk Vasuli Mikdash v'shachanti betochan is missing in Vayakel. And basically, the Shabbat is the, it's what you're saying, Shabbat is the replacement for Basuli Mikdash v'Shachanti B'tocham, because the Shachanti Mishkan, nobody saw the Mishkan. It's too powerful. It was in the Kodesh HaKodashim, and it's very distant. Shabbat is more powerful. The kind of what you were saying now at the end. The Shabbat is accessible to everybody, and God replaced his divine presence in the Mishkan with his divine presence on Shabbat, and that's the connection between Shabbat and Mishkan. I think a very similar idea. So where's Mechavein, but so thank you very much.
Very good. You bet. A pleasure.
Yeah. So, okay. Okay. Any questions, comments, Vakasha? Otherwise, I just put the registration. If you haven't registered for a Pesach program, I must say this is really an amazing program. We have 21 speakers. We have our Yom Iyun next Sunday on the Haggadah. 6 speakers going through the Haggadah, 45 minutes each. Menachem Liebtag, Rebecca Winter, Tzvi Grammit, Lori Novak, David Silver. And then we have for 2 weeks or 10 days, basically 2 shirim a day on Pesach, every day at 11. And one except the shir that, of course, I'll give on Friday at 9:15, the regular time, and probably not Erev Pesach, probably the Thursday before Erev Pesach also. So I just put, you can register for both. It's 2 separate programs, because of the way it works. But so I do invite you to that. Of course, this Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag will give his regular shirim on his regular series. Him and Benny Gesundheit will both be giving the regular shirim. Mark Shapiro is not speaking this week. He'll be back next week. Rabbi Shulman is speaking. We'll have the regular shirim, and everything for Pesach will start the following week. I hope that's clear.
Wow.
You'll join us.
Oh, that's great to know.
Yeah, and I'll say, I'm sorry?
No, I should put it in our WhatsApp. It sounds great.
Yeah, I'll send you. It's really 2 separate. Yeah, they're really excellent program. I asked Mark Graffa to do a flyer, but you'll see on the website. Go to the website, click on the link. You'll see both the programs. Really, A1 lineup. That's it. Then my regular shear on the sitter. Of course, last week did on Purim. Tomorrow morning, 9:15, we're up to Ritzay, the middle of Ritzay, Modim, the last 3 brach of the Shemone Esrei. Everybody's welcome. And otherwise, we'll say thank you very much, Rabbi. And
thank you. Pleasure.
Keep things calm in Washington. They're a little bit too lively for my liking. So
I'm working on it. You can blame me if things don't go well.
I won't blame you, but it's wow. Okay. Anyways, we should hear good news from Israel. It's from all over, and I don't know what to say. And they're going to be calling. Not that the Americans don't care, but probably on Sunday. The Canadian election is going to be called for April 28th. I will tell you, the President of the United States has resurrected the Liberal Party in Canada. So I don't know if you know the news. The Conservatives had literally a 25-point lead in the polls. Like the Liberals, people were sick and tired of them. And they had a 25-point lead 6 weeks ago. It's neck and neck now. And it's really unbelievable. And that's 90% of that is due to one person who lives near you.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to knock on the door.
Knock on the door. Anyways, okay, enough politics, but only after the shear is over, so it doesn't count. We're here for Torah. Okay, thank you very much.
Right, be well. Shabbat thank
shalom.
You.
A special Shabbat shalom after that shear. Thank you. Okay, be well, everybody. Hope to see you soon. Invite a friend to come and join our learning. Bakasha.